This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with host Lisa Loving. Today's guest is civil rights attorney Malloy Good, and our topic is affordable housing. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Raven's Flight Creative, presenting an evening with author, comedian, inventor, and mustache enthusiast John Hodgman from The Daily Show. John Hodgman speaks at the Baghdad Theater Thursday, March 7th at 7 p.m. The Baghdad Theater is at 3702 Southeast Hawthorne, and accompanied minors are welcome. Tickets at cascadetickets.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, celebrating Black History Month and welcoming journalist and civil rights activist Charlene Hunter Gault, February 28th at the Portland Art Museum. Ticket info at pcc.edu.
And you're listening to Mighty Mighty KBOO in Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. And today, every report on the subject says there isn't enough affordable housing in Oregon. But inclusionary zoning, which could require developers building out housing complexes to include units for low-income renters or owners, is illegal. We're live in the studio with civil rights attorney Malloy Good. We're going to be looking at a new bill in the state legislature to change that. And we're also going to be looking at a new group that has formed to challenge some of these issues called Connecting Communities of Oregon. Also, listeners, are you on Section 8? We'd also like to talk a little bit about Section 8 discrimination. How did you get signed up and how long did it take for you to get a place to live? So we're going to go there in a minute. But Malloy, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Malloy, can you talk a little bit about, I don't know, this issue of inclusionary zoning and how is it that it looks like money, government money, taxpayer money that could and should be invested in the local community to create affordable housing has had kind of the opposite effect in a way? Talk about this issue.
Sure. Well, to begin the discussion about affordable housing, you actually need to go all the way back to the Fair Housing Act, which was passed in 1968. That was the first law that said it was illegal to discriminate in housing transactions anywhere in this country. So the Fair Housing Act had two main goals. One was to advance equal opportunity in housing, which basically means enforcing against individuals who violate the law and engage in acts of discrimination. But another goal that is often overlooked was that we needed to achieve integration for the benefit of all our citizens. So the way that this relates to affordable housing is a very powerful tool that can be used to achieve integration in a community. This is because, as we all know from study after study, the low-income population is disproportionately represented by people of color, people with disabilities, families with children, especially single mothers. And all of those are individuals who are protected under the Fair Housing Act against discrimination.
All right. And I also, just as background on this issue, the Oregonian newspaper last year did a massive, like, game-changing series about this issue. Incredibly controversial. It was called Locked Out: The Failure of Portland Area Fair Housing. And I know that there are people listening right now that are critical of the Oregonian, but this series really freaked out local government and local nonprofit organizations that are supposedly doing stuff around fair housing. And I just wanted to share a little bit of information about this. Okay, Locked Out: The Failure of Portland Area Fair Housing, Part 1, Failure to Support Fair Housing Act Leads to Subsidized Segregation. I'm just reading a little bit from the landing page. Taxpayer money meant to create affordable and desirable housing for the poor and people of color instead pushes them into the Portland area's worst neighborhoods. Portland's Section 8 clients shifted east of 82nd, and agencies' decisions to force the exile of people of color and the poor from Portland's inner east side. Some of the issues discussed in the series: fair housing oversight fails at multiple levels, affordable housing in the Portland area, race and poverty. They even looked at the richer areas like Lake Oswego and drilled into how much affordable housing is there. And I feel like in Lake Oswego, did they find like one house? It was really interesting.
Right. No, Lake Oswego has very little affordable housing. And actually, just a week or so ago, the City Council of Lake Oswego voted down an affordable housing project that would have gone into the new Foothills development. So they're continuing to resist the efforts to include affordable housing in their community.
It's totally fascinating. And I want to read this other part. Locked Out, this series in the Oregonian that Brad Schmidt completed. The thing was kind of inspired by a former investigative reporter there named Nicole Hannah Jones, who moved last year to New York to be a reporter for ProPublica, investigative reporters. So I just want to read this, though. And to me, this is the real point. About this series, it says on the landing page, the Oregonian met resistance in seeking public records for this series. Portland Housing Bureau officials released project-specific data for more than 150 projects, only under pressure from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. City officials charged the newspaper $1,162 for the information. Home Forward, Multnomah County's housing authority, spent nearly $15,000 in legal fees to fight the Oregonian's request for location-specific Section 8 data. We're going to move on to Section 8 discrimination in a minute. Huge! The district attorney's office ordered the information released in December. The housing authority of Clackamas County estimated it would require the newspaper to pay $2,000 for documents, but only charged them in the end $268. The Oregonian began looking into fair housing after reporting last year by Nicole Hannah Jones, who left the newspaper in December. The Oregonian's Brad Schmidt did all this work. Anyway, to me, what I saw happen with this was a whole lot of housing agencies and people that are largely considered to be liberal, even progressive people who are staffing these agencies, basically couldn't deny that their work had been ineffective. I mean, I'm putting it out like that, Malloy. I don't want to put you on the hot seat per se, but I mean, when you look at that whole issue of the Oregonian spending thousands and thousands of dollars, and I think a year, maybe 6 months, a year investigating this thing to try to crack this information out of the housing authority, you know, what did it mean that it took this effort just to be able to get this information? That's how our taxpayer dollars are spent. I mean, what's the gist of this whole issue with that?
Well, let me start by saying I completely agree with you about the Locked Out series. That was a tremendous investigative effort by Brad and Nicole, and the analysis that they put together was just truly amazing, and they should be commended for that. Because it really did shine a light in an area that I think a lot of us in the fair housing and the affordable housing community knew was a problem, but weren't quite sure how to address in a meaningful way. And that's exactly what the series shows, is that taxpayer dollars that are meant to go to affordable, to create housing for low income people, again, you know, a population that is overrepresented by different protected class populations, was not being done in a way that created integration. And over the years, there's been a constant debate and a tension, and there exists a tension, and there should, between affordable housing advocates that want to provide as many units as possible with the money that they have versus advocates, primarily fair housing advocates, who want to see units located in areas of high opportunity or desirable neighborhoods that, that will achieve this integrative effect.
So we're looking at concentration of poverty or not. That's kind of what we're looking at.
Correct. And for well over a decade, the pendulum has been on the side of more housing is better than housing located in desirable.
Better housing.
Correct.
Is that, could we say more housing versus better housing? Is that accurate? In a way. Not exactly, though.
Perhaps better locate housing in better locations. When you look at the data that Brad and Nicole were able to find, you see that over this time, we have engaged in resegregation of, you know, largely people of color. And that's, you know, that's just evident by the work that they did and the maps that they were able to generate showing where low income people are living now, which is largely in East County, where new developments are largely going in, which is also in the same area where the land is cheaper, which from a nonprofit affordable housing developer, that makes some sense because I want to build where I can afford the land. But that's the city or the county, you know, whether it's the city of Portland, the city of Gresham, Multnomah County, city of Beaverton, Hillsborough, Washington County, Clackamas, all of these jurisdictions, it's their job to be on top of that and to make sure that the money that they're using is going to allow affordable housing to be built in these areas that are what we now call areas of high opportunity that have good access to transportation.
Schools, jobs, shopping, not a food desert. We also have a banking desert in East Portland that I never, ever hear people talk about. And again, going to this thing, and then we're going to go to the phone lines. But this thing of how hard these agencies, the city's housing bureau, housing authority, how hard they fought to literally, I'm just going to say, cover it up. That's just the way it looks to me. To keep the media, to keep the Oregonian from getting this information. To me, that's an interesting part of the story, too. In my mind, I'm sure that the people at the housing authority, people in the city of Portland had this conversation about what you just said. Well, our strategy is to try to get more bang for our buck, as they say. But why not just roll the information out and just put all the cards on the table? I wonder about that.
Yeah, I don't know what their reasoning was. I'm sure they had what they thought were good reasons, mm-hmm. but as I've learned over the years, the public records laws in this state are very powerful and. So it's not surprising to me that they ultimately had to turn this stuff over.
Right. And they're saying Home Forward, that's the Housing Authority of Portland, spent nearly $15,000 in legal fees to fight these Oregonian requests just to find out where the housing went, where the housing money went.
Right.
And that's your taxpayer dollars, listeners. Like I'm telling you something that you don't already know. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live in the studio with civil rights attorney Malloy Good. And we are we have the phone lines open. And I want to put this out, people. Are you on Section 8? How'd you get signed up? And how long did it take you to get a place to live? And are you east of 82nd? That's something we're going to be talking about in a minute. Section 8 discrimination. And we're going to go to the phone lines. We have Sean on the phone. Sean, what do you think? What's going on?
Hey, good morning. I'm on Section 8 housing. I'm over here in Clark County. And my experience was, I think, kind of typical of what takes place over here. I originally went on the waiting list for public housing in 2002, but I moved and forgot to tell Vancouver Housing Authority that I moved, and so I immediately went to the bottom of the waiting list. So I got back on the waiting list in 2004, and then it took 6 years of being on the waiting list till 2010. And one additional component to this is a mental health component. I was in an extreme mental health crisis, very suicidal at one point back in 2002, and it's this crazy obstacle course that the mentally ill have to negotiate. There are so few inpatient mental health beds, and the hospitals are only being used for stabilization. You're lucky if you're in for like a week or 2 weeks. and then boom, you're right back out on the street. So, like, it's this crazy obstacle course that the mentally ill have to negotiate in order to get on SSI, to get on food stamps, to get on Section 8 housing. And I think it's just, I consider myself extremely lucky to have survived. I mean, I was renting out rooms. I was living in single room occupancy apartments, and it was crazy ridiculous what I had to go through in order to make it to 2010 to finally receive the housing voucher and get into an excellent apartment.
Wow.
So that's my experience.
Thanks for calling, Sean.
Thank you.
Sean put a big one on the table there, the issue of mental health. And when we're talking about Section 8, we're talking about affordable housing. We don't always sit here and go, what about, you know, how does this relate to a lot of the people that we see living on the street right now? It's a huge issue. And anyway, were you going to say something, Malloy?
Well, I think Sean illustrates an issue with that Section 8 voucher holders or prospective Section 8 voucher holders face, which is getting on Section 8 is very difficult. Even getting a voucher is a long and arduous process that has a lot of bureaucratic, forms to be filled out, meetings to attend, things like that. So it is not just a simple walk down to your local housing authority and they'll hand you a voucher.
No, and I feel as though last year the housing authority opened up the waiting list. They only open up the waiting list for Section 8 every occasional period. It's not always open. You can't just go down there and sign up on a list like you're at a restaurant or something like that.
Right, and that's just the waiting list.
Right.
That's not even that there are new vouchers or vouchers ready for people on the waiting list to have. So we have a huge problem in across the country. This isn't just in Portland, but the underfunding of housing costs is huge. I did want to talk about that. You know, we're talking about affordable housing and location, and the role that the two issues we're talking about today, inclusionary zoning and Section 8, play with that. Inclusionary zoning, which is getting a lot of talk, and a lot of people may not fully understand
it. Thank you.
Basically, what it is it's the ability of a city or a county to pass a law that says, okay, Mr. Developer, if you're going to build your 300-unit McMansion or, you know, high-rise for, you know, relatively well-off people, we, the city, want you to include as part of that some percentage of those units that are affordable for people under a certain income level. And, you know, the cities and counties can tailor it to what fits their needs. So, you know, a lot of people places that use this will say, you know, families that are 60% or below the median family income or, you know, other things like that. Some cities require 20%, some cities require 10%. And it just varies all across the country, but it allows the city to say, look, this goal of integration is a community goal and we all bear responsibility for it. And right now in Oregon, the legislature in 1999 had passed a law that said cities and counties cannot use this tool that says they will, that the city could require this affordable housing be provided as part of a new development. What is allowed is the city can provide incentives and say, you know, we'll waive fees, we'll allow you, instead of, you know, the maximum number of units being 300, we'll allow you to build 330 or whatever. So they can try to incentivize the developer to include affordable housing in their project, but there's no requirement that the developer do that. And so, again, when you look back over the time period that the lockout series followed, you can see that what that has resulted in is segregated housing patterns. And there are places like Lake Oswego, like Westland, that are, you know, that do not have their fair share of affordable housing. And, you know, their demographics reflect that. And the lockout series focused on North Bethany, which is a new project that's being proposed, and the efforts of the Washington County to get some affordable housing in there and the resistance they were meeting because the incentives that were on the table were just simply not not enough for the developer, at least it sounded like from the article, were not enough for them to go ahead and include affordable housing as part of that.
So looking at free market versus our community deciding what we need and making that take place. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're live in the studio with civil rights attorney Malloy Good. We're talking about affordable housing. We've got Section 8 discrimination on the table, and we got a full slate of callers. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Joanne. Joanne.
Yeah, in regard to Sean's call, somebody in this country has got to have the courage to do a program on and start a discussion on who truly are the mentally ill in this country. But in the meantime, I live in public housing, and we have to sign a new lease, and we got a letter that said if we don't sign it, we may lose or we'll lose our housing. You know, I got to stop listening to Democracy Now. Like this morning about young informants for the police. You know what? Every time I listen every day, it just supports what I've been believing for some time. There is no real help or justice for people in my life situation. And that's all for now.
Thank you, Joanne. And Joanne, it's interesting. We're talking about affordable housing. Joanne lives in a public housing complex. I last year went and visited someone who lives in a public housing complex right by where I work. And I met a lot of people there. And it struck me that virtually everyone in that complex was afraid that they would do something that would cause them to lose their housing. They literally lived in fear. They literally lived in fear. And I had no idea. I had no idea. And we have a full slate of callers. Let's go back to the phone lines. Conch is on the phone. Conch, what's going on?
Hey, I'm really delighted that Mr. Good is talking about this issue, getting it out in the open. The incentives, like you said, the incentives for building affordable housing are just toothless. And it's not just a Portland thing either. I can remember in Chicago where these huge, tall high-rises went up and the developers said, hey, if you give us a tax break, we're going to put in a whole bunch of affordable units for all the people who need them in this town. And the legislators said, yeah, you got it. Like, we won't tax you very much at all. And then the units went in and they said, you know what, we're just going to sell every one of these to rich people. And the folks in charge said, oh, okay, you can do that. And you can keep your tax break, too. And, you know, the rest of us all pay for this. The incentives, you know, we can hear all this lovely, bogus, beautiful chin music about how these wonderful developers are going to be able to get all these folks off the street and with our tax dollars, and then our tax dollars go out the door and nothing happens. It's kind of like when Intel says, oh, we'll get a whole bunch of workers in there, and they don't, and they still get their awesome tax break.
Right. And I love the phrase chin music. It's awesome. And Conch, the other thing that strikes me, and maybe Malloy could speak to this a little bit too, is that a whole lot of the development in the Pearl, right, we had that kind of incentives, and there's an issue about what it means that we are theoretically creating some kind of public institution using taxpayer money that's temporary. I mean, I feel as though in my memory, some of the housing deals that have been made in Portland, I want to say south of Waterfront, but also most specifically in the Pearl while it was being built up 10 years ago, those affordable housing designations were temporary. They said, we're going to make these affordable for the first period of time, 10 years, and then after that they go to market rate or something like that. And I don't see people revisiting that to see how those contracts have played out. Although there was a really interesting interview with one of the big developers in the Willy Week last week, because he's in bankruptcy court, but he's about to swing like a $12 million housing deal. Fascinating. But Conch, thanks a ton for calling. And we do have a full slate of callers. Let's go back to the phone line. We have Catherine on the phone. Catherine, what's going on?
Well, when I heard you were going to talk about affordable housing, I was thrilled because I've had Section 8 and it saved my life and blessed me no end. And I was thinking about, I always wanted to spread the good news about Habitat for Humanity. And then I was thinking, well, maybe we could have a partnership with them and we could have sweat equity going on between people that needed housing and maybe even people that are unemployed and would like to help and that are already receiving public housing could put sweat equity into refurbishing what we already have here. So that's my idea.
All right.
Partnership with Habitat for Humanity.
All right. You know, it's interesting, Catherine, because after this big series came out in the Oregonian last year, somewhere I saw someone link to an article in the New York Times about a gigantic complex that the Habitat for Humanity was building, I want to say building out in East Portland, and they were only able to do it because years ago, a really affluent man looked at Habitat for Humanity and said, this is a great organization, and I'm going to leave them $1 million in my will. And they took this money. It was fascinating. Malloy, can you speak? You were just nodding. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not familiar with that specifically, but what I completely agree with is, you know,
the partnerships.
There are committed and dedicated nonprofit housing developers out there. Habitat for Humanity. They're at the federal, state, and local levels, and. You know, I'm sure there are really good ones and ones that aren't always that great. But, also locally, PCRI is a nonprofit housing developer.
I think PCRI does a really fabulous job. And they do actually they offer a lot of services to local people in the community to educate them about opportunities, especially senior citizens, people trapped on a limited income. They really get hosed sometimes in these situations.
Right. And then I think it was Conch was talking about how this was a problem he had seen as well in Chicago.
Absolutely.
And, you know, this isn't a problem that is unique to Portland. It isn't a problem that is unique to Oregon. What is unique here is that I believe we as a society have thought those problems that Chicago has, those problems that New York has, those problems that Boston has aren't problems we have. And unfortunately, we do have those problems. But fortunately, we have the ability to try and address them and achieve equity with our housing policy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. And thanks for calling, Catherine. Really appreciate your call. And I feel as though I want to put a shout out to other people who are involved in this new wonderful organization called Connecting Communities of Oregon to give us a call and let us know there's a bunch of events coming up.
Yes.
Maybe Malloy has them written down. And you know who got me on this whole thing in the first place? Cameron Witten. You go to his Facebook, his job is listed as weight loss specialist at Portland City Hall. Zing! I love that. Do you want to just reel off these events that are coming up, Malloy?
Sure.
And then we'll go back to the phone line.
So, I do want to just talk about briefly. So, for me personally, I'm a member of the Portland Human Rights Commission, and when the lockdown series came out, we saw this as a direct human rights issue, and we formed a subgroup of us to really delve into these issues of Section 8 discrimination, the ban on inclusionary zoning. And as part of that, we joined up with other like-minded community organizations, the Community Alliance of Tenants, OPAL, the Center for Intercultural Organizing, and several others. And that coalition has formed this Connecting Communities of Oregon group. And Mr. Witten is very active with that, and we really appreciate everything that he's been doing. But what we've got coming up, we actually introduced a bill or had legislators introduce a bill called, it's House Bill 2890, and it's very basic. It just says that the ban on inclusionary zoning is repealed. To support passage of that bill, there's going to be a housing justice rally on March 14th down in Salem. And I want to encourage your listeners to mark that date down and to try and become involved in attending that event. Obviously the question is how do you do that? I've got some contact information here for you for the Connecting Communities of Oregon. Our email address is oregonconnect@gmail.com. Folks should feel free to email if they're interested in learning more about what's going on. We also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/oregonconnect. And we're also on Twitter, twitter.com/oregonconnect. I'm part of the older part of Generation X, so these are still sort of, Twitter and Facebook are a bit new to me, but we have folks like Cameron and others who are much more knowledgeable about them and how to utilize them. So, and those are definitely the ways that we're going to use to notify people about other events that we put together, including, you know, we might do some workshops, we might do some trainings and things like that. So that's what CCO has on the plate so far.
All right. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're live in the studio with Malloy Good. He's a civil rights attorney. And we are talking about Section 8 discrimination. We're talking about inclusionary zoning. We're talking about concrete things that we can mess around with to actually achieve affordable housing in our state, so that people don't get bunched up in what's the term that we're looking at? It's like concentrations of poverty in places. So, and we're asking the question, are you on Section 8? How did you get signed up for it? How long did it take you to get a place to live? And do you live east of 82nd? And the call-in number, of course, is 503-231-8187. And we're going to go back to the phone lines. We've got Mark on the line. Mark, what's going on?
Yeah, a couple questions. One is, in order for the city to make Section 8 housing, couldn't they just take over certain properties through eminent domain to do that?
Do you want us to take these one at a time, or do you want to throw all your questions out?
I'll throw the other one out. The other one is I'm a math teacher, and sometimes I look with students over mortgage rates, and it seems to me that most people paying rent for apartments could actually own that apartment for the same rent or less, but they can't get a loan, and they don't have any money down. So even if you are in a not good situation, many times you can actually own the place you're living with or without any Section 8 support, but the banks won't give you the money or someone won't sell it to you.
You know, Mark put his finger on a big one, because before he signed off, Sean was pointing out the securitization of the housing market through Wall Street shenanigans with mortgage repacking, slicing, and dicing. I never want to stray too far from the fraud in the banking industry, of which the federal government has cracked down in the tiniest possible way. And even when the federal government, they're suing Standard & Poor's for fraud, right? There was some kind of thing around Wells Fargo, I believe, this past week, again, looking at fraud. And these big banking institutions, actually, it's debt buying institutions, they're getting fined and they're getting multi-billion dollar fines, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to how much money they made. Anyway, thanks for calling, Mark, and let's dive into that. The issues that Mark brought up. This is the thing that's so complicated, I think, about affordable housing, is the federal government's responsibility, the federal connection versus the local connection. And sometimes, Malloy, I feel like this is like education, where you have conservatives at the top, conservatives, right-wing conservatives in the Beltway, helping to create some of these policies and these rules, and then handing them down to Democrats on the local level, who are like, here we go. You know, it's a weird dialect, but go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, Mark raised some really interesting ideas. As far as eminent domain goes, the ability of the city or the county to purchase property or seize isn't quite the right word, but yeah, to take it. You know, that's definitely something that's a long and difficult process and also very expensive. My feeling is it would be better to try and achieve these through the existing zoning rules and regulations that we have, where you can say, look, you need to build affordable housing here rather than just taking it over. But if a particular place is a problem, then perhaps the city should be looking at those kinds of solutions as a way to upgrade and make sure that that the housing that's being provided is safe and quality. The lending issue and the role that banks have played in our housing crisis could be a whole, you know, month worth of shows to talk about. And, you know, the ability of the federal government to deal with this is sort of, it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you have some of these settlements with Wells Fargo, with Bank of America, for, you know, through Countrywide, some of these other large banks and mortgage servicers, and these are historic settlements. But you're absolutely right. When you delve down into it, it seems like it's just a drop in the bucket.
Cost of doing business.
Right. And it's just unclear whether it's going to really change the behavior of these of the lenders. And part of the problem is, you know, the lenders that are targeting vulnerable populations are usually one or two steps ahead of the regulators. And so we're dealing now with trends and issues that were going on, you know, 5-10 years ago. And in 5 and 10 years, we'll find out what are the problems that are going on today, and we'll start seeing, you know, resolutions about them.
Amazing. And although I'm kind of psyched about Mark's, his vision of if the city could go to, I mean, this is the way I hear, this is what I hear him saying when he says eminent domain. I mean, most of the time when somebody's property is being grabbed, it's, I'm just putting this out. Most of the time that I've ever seen that, it's been poor people's property. But what we're talking about is trying to give real resources to poor people. So the vision of going to one of these luxury apartments and eminent domaining 10 units cracks me up. That just cracks me up. And I just want to savor that image of what that would look like. But the other thing, Mark, the thing that is amazing, again, with these are federal. We're specifically talking about federal civil rights law as it affects home ownership and housing and, I guess, property ownership. I don't know. And so when you look at how the federal government passes things down to the local government, it people have all these straitjackets on. And what really gets me is I look around this town, and I'm sure, of course, it's the same all over the country. It seems like we give all these tools to our government agencies to give tax breaks to already rico organizations and companies. But when it comes time to help some really poor person or an elderly person on a fixed income, when it comes time to try to help them deal with the debt that's been saddled on them by the failure of the banking industry, oh no, we can't do that. There's all these rules against that, and it never ceases to amaze me. Really burns my toast. And we've got a full slate of callers. Let's go back to the phone lines. John, what's on your mind?
Question for your guest.
Yes, sir.
So, hypothetically, you're a landlord. Why don't you want to accept Section 8?
Excellent question. Thank you. Do you have any other questions, John?
Well, I want to hear his answer, then I might have something to add.
All right. Well, we have a full slate of callers, so we're starting to sort of keep people short.
I'm
short, so I don't see it bad. Your landlord. Okay. Thanks for calling, John. Go ahead and answer that. This is an interesting one, and it is a huge issue.
Right. Well, so the landlords will give you a number of different reasons why they don't want to accept Section 8. They don't want to be involved in a
federal program.
Federal program.
As soon as you start filling out all those federal forms, if you do it wrong, you can get popped and slapped in the face really hard.
Right. I mean, there is a you know, an administrative cost to being part of Section 8. The other issue is, you know, sometimes the housing authorities, you know, they have a process they go through where they have to inspect the unit, and that can take some time. And landlords have expressed frustration that they, you know, your unit sits vacant and they're not getting rent on it. So there are a number of horror stories out there for landlord that the landlords will tell you. But you know, this is guaranteed rent. This, you know, when you rent to a voucher holder, you know that some or all of their rent is being paid by the housing authority, and that check is going to come every month. And the, you know, it's no different than any other form of income that a person may have that's not generated by a job or, you know, some kind of wage. So it to me, it just is the same as anything else. And it's just a matter of equity and fairness that people with Section 8 vouchers should be allowed to use that voucher wherever they choose, and they shouldn't be turned away simply because they have a voucher.
But this is the interesting thing about that, and that's why I'm bringing this up, about when we get these policies or programs pounded down by conservatives at the federal level to Democrats at the local level that have to make it work. I mean, there are real reasons why let me put it this way. Mixing your Section 8, your government program, with a free market concept, right? Because that's kind of what we're talking about. It's a little government. It's a little free market, right? There are incentives for people not to want to rent to Section 8 people if they're paranoid about being part of a federal system. You know, what if the feds crack down? Oh, I'm losing a month of rent because they have to have bureaucrats come out and inspect the corners or whatever. It's almost, I'm putting it to you, Malloy. I know that well-meaning people are pushing these policies, but it's almost like it's set up to be hard. It's almost like it's set up to fail in some ways. I mean, and go ahead and argue with me about it, because I don't want to believe that, but it looks like it, you know?
No, I mean, it's interesting that you talk about the genesis, and actually, I mean, I don't know the full genesis of the Section 8 program, but I know that it was started when Jack Kemp, who was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under, I think, the first President Bush. This was one of his ideas about how to integrate free market principles with subsidized housing. And the idea with a voucher, and it's a noble idea that...
It's an idea for do-gooders. You have right. to be a do-gooder. I'm putting that out.
Right. No, it is that this person who is low income and could not afford to live on their own, you know, with the money that they're getting, they're able to take this voucher and go live in a neighborhood that perhaps, you know, there is no subsidized housing complex, there is no other affordable housing option if the landlord's willing to take them. But as with all really noble ideas, it's all about execution. And what the locked out series shows is that the execution has been Section 8 voucher holders are routinely denied. Mm-hmm. They are now being relocated and, east of 82nd Avenue. And the promise of the vouchers, the integrative promise of vouchers, is not being realized because landlords can say no without any impunity. If the law is changed, and there are bills, and in fact, the Human Rights Commission urged Senator Shields to sponsor a bill that would end Section 8 discrimination, and that's pending in this legislature as well. As well as we all know, Speaker Kotek has her own bill that tries to achieve the same thing. It doesn't mean that landlords need to take people who are, you know, who have particularly bad criminal history or who have particularly bad rental history. They're still able to screen people, but one of the screening criteria can't be the fact that they have a voucher. That in and of itself can't be a reason to say no.
I see.
So, and right now you can. You if you open the paper or go on Craigslist, you see ads all the time that say no Section 8.
No Section 8. All right. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host. My name is Lisa. We're live in the studio with civil rights attorney Malloy Good. We're talking about affordable housing. We're specifically talking about the new campaign to end the ban on inclusionary zoning in the state of Oregon. We're talking about Section 8 discrimination as well. And we have a full slate of callers. Let's go back to the phone lines. Jeff is on the line. Jeff, what's going on?
We talk a lot about the nature of social problems and the whole disagreement, you know, on the right and the left is what's the solution for social problems. And then we get involved with what are changing the structures. In this case, what you guys are talking about is the structure of laws and rules about where things can happen and when. But there's a whole other aspect of structure, and that is that the built environment, architecture, and the placement of homes and how much space is around them and whether or not they're insulated, you know, it's like for sound or whatever, if they're next to highways, if they're in places where there's industrial, you know, they're industrial areas.
Boil it down for us, Jeff. Where are you going?
Well, I just wanted to say that that's another aspect of structure that is a big part of this conversation that I didn't hear you bring up, and so I just wanted to bring it up.
So, Jeff, actually, I think that is the point, is that with the inclusionary housing, the idea is that what you're saying, I mean, there are some neighborhoods that are just more desirable than others. There are some places that have more infrastructure, places right. that
yeah,
have
I'm
grocery
talk-
store. You're talking about, are you right by the freeway and stuff like that? That's part of it, too.
Even more so, I'm talking about the actual structure of the place in which we live. You know,
our neighborhoods, and our buildings.
No, the rooms, the internal structure, the architecture of the internal structure, and how it affects family development and all of the rest of that sort of thing.
All right, that's completely fascinating. Thanks a lot. I had not considered it. What are you going to say, Lauren?
That's a very good point. And another aspect about inclusionary zoning that's somewhat tangential. You know, new multifamily housing construction has to meet certain accessibility standards for people with disabilities, people with mobility impairments, sight impairments. And with, an inclusionary zoning ordinance, the city's going to know that this new development that they're having in this high opportunity area is going to not just be there for low-income people, but it's going to be additional accessible housing for people with disabilities so that they can live in these high opportunity areas. What Jeff was talking about with being near the freeway, and I know that wasn't necessarily his direct point, but the environmental factors that poor people have to endure living in the neighborhoods that they're living in is another aspect where inclusionary zoning can seek to alleviate, because it will will help with transportation costs. It will help with reducing the health and environmental factors that face people, because they can live in areas that are nearer green spaces or are farther away from environmentally undesirable places. So inclusionary zoning, while we've talked about it in the context of fair housing, it touches on pretty much every aspect of our lives. You know, we mentioned education, we talked about transportation, the environment, public health. This has a beneficial effect on all of those. It won't solve those problems by itself, but it is certainly a first step that the communities want to be able to take, and right now they're prevented from demanding that action from their city or county by the state law.
And we have more callers. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Pear on the phone. Pear, what's going on?
Oh, hey, how you doing? Very interesting topic. You know, I used to own a duplex on Belmont. It was an older building with a storefront that the city wouldn't let me use. But I never heard of Section 8 until a woman asked me about it, and so I checked it out, and it seemed like a pretty neat arrangement. You know, I'd be sure I'd get my rent and all that kind of stuff. But then the city had this list of things that had to be done, repairs and everything, and it would have cost me more than I didn't have the money for it, you know.
That's interesting. I'm really interested in these issues around the complications of Section 8.
When I first moved to Portland, I used to rent it, living over Northwest, and you know, I didn't mind having an apartment that was kind of little ratty if the rent was low. That's the way I felt, you know. But, you know, like there were so many things that I had to do to this old building that it just, I just sort of gave up on it, you know.
What did you do to the building? Did you sell the building in the end?
I gave it to my sons, and then they lived there for quite a while, and then they sold it. So somebody's got it now, and they have the money to, needed a lot of foundation work and stuff. So they're keeping the building, which is very nice, you know.
All right. Thanks for calling, Pear.
Sure.
And, you know, like we mentioned earlier, I mean, the inspections that come with taking a Section 8 voucher are an additional administrative issue that landlords have to deal with. What I can tell you, though, is my experience with this is on the other side, where my clients are wanting the housing authority to get the inspection done, to pass the inspection.
Your clients who are property owners?
No, who are low-income tenants.
Okay.
And so what people need to understand that, you know, landlords have to wait for these inspections to be done, but the tenants have to wait too. And they're not in that housing while the Section 8 or Housing Authority does their inspection. I'm also not certain. I've talked with some Housing Authority people who somewhat counter the idea that there are these really long periods of time where inspections, you know, it takes to get inspections done. So I don't know exactly how long that really is. I know that the folks at Home Forward, I know that the folks at the Washington County Housing Authority try to get these done in, you know, in a matter of days. But the tenants out of the housing while that's going on, if the housing fails inspection, either, you know, when they're first trying to move in or after they've been living there for a while, they're in danger of losing their housing. So it's a burden on the tenants too. And like I said, most of my clients, when this issue comes up, it's on the other side where the landlord is simply saying, look, I don't want to make that repair. I don't care, you know, because it's too expensive. And the landlord's willing to walk away from the Section 8 program over it. And the tenant's like, well, now I need to find a new place. And what am I going to do? I have 30 days. And not only am I losing my house, but if I don't find a new place, I'm going to lose my voucher.
Right. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live in the studio with civil rights attorney Malloy Good. We're talking about inclusionary zoning, the effort to end the ban on that in the state of Oregon. We've talked a little bit about the new organization, Connecting Communities of Oregon. They're going to have a lobbying day in Salem. Is it a lobbying day?
It's a housing justice rally. I think we will be trying to organize meetings with legislators.
Right on. And that's coming up in March. And we have a full slate of callers. We're going to go back to the phone lines. We have John on the phone. John, what's going on?
So when you had this thing in March, is Metro Multifamily Housing going to be in opposition to what you're trying to do?
I don't know that they have a position on the inclusionary zoning bill.
Because I heard at one point there was some legislation that was trying to be passed where, you know, landlords could not refuse Section 8, but Metro Multifamily Housing went to bat and put the brakes on that.
Right. The effort to make it illegal to discriminate against Section 8 voucher holders has been tried in the past, and the landlord organizations, of which Metro Multifamily Housing Association is one, have opposed those efforts. It's unclear, you know, I've been seeing some of the press reports around Speaker Kotek's bill. It is unclear to me, from what I've read, whether they plan to oppose it this time as well or not. They may have even come out and said one way or the other.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time nailing down why exactly landlords are opposed to Section 8. I never really was aware of it until recently. I've had a lot of phone calls asking me if I would accept Section 8. And when the building got handed off to me when I bought it, the comment from the previous owner was, don't ever accept Section 8.
Right.
All right. Thanks for calling, John.
And
thanks for calling, John.
And wait. One of the things... major thing that he said was that when they move out, if there's damages, you can't collect. There's no recourse.
Right.
I don't know about that.
Against them.
So
thanks for calling, John.
And that's, I mean, you know, so we've talked a bit about why landlords might say they don't want Section 8, but I think that a lot of times, on a lot of landlords I've heard say it's basically their assumptions about what a Section 8 tenant is and how they're going to treat the unit and how they're going to be as a tenant, which is all, you know, some of it may be based on past experience or rumors they've heard and stories they've heard from other landlords, like John just said. But I've talked with a lot of landlords who have really good experiences with Section 8 tenants and absolutely adore having them because they're really good, because they really want to keep their place.
Do-gooders. Anyway, and let's go back to the phone lines. We have Tim on the phone. Tim, what do you think?
Oh, I just have a quick question. Can we just uncomplicate this mess and make it transparent by making everybody a stakeholder?
Explain.
Well, my wife and I live in public housing. My wife is disabled, and there's a lot of it's confusing and complicated as to what the processes are with public housing managers, okay, and what they do and why they do it. They're very autocratic, and HUD is different than Section 8,
mm-hmm.
but it's all public housing. And so the people that live in any of this, whether Section 8 or HUD, don't have a clue what it is that's going on with those that are in control. So why not make everybody a part of the process? Make everybody a stakeholder, whether they're actually wanting to move into these places, whether they live in them, or just everybody that's in the community, so there's, you know, transparency, so that everybody knows what's going on.
I honor your vision. I honor your vision. What were you going to say, Malloy?
Well, I like exactly what Tim is saying. And part of what my effort and the effort of Connecting Communities of Oregon and the Human Rights Commission, what we're trying to do is make it clear to everyone that we are all stakeholders in this, that if Tim and his wife succeed in their housing, that is a success for all of us. And we need that and we want that. And this is a way, you know, we have not utilized our policies. We have not allocated our resources in a way that achieves that kind of goal. We've done some good things, but we need to do better.
All right. Tim, are you still there? Tim, do you have a tiny, adorable dog?
We have a chihuahua, yes.
All right. I approve. Thanks.
Yes, she's very sweet.
Thank you. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're starting to run out of show. And Tim put some really fascinating things on the table there. And what I, you know, last week on these airwaves, we had the director and producer of the film American Winter, which is basically a film about just about poverty and the dynamics of poverty. It was filmed in Portland last winter. And what strikes me about what Tim said about HUD housing, and when I was talking earlier about the woman that I spent time with last year, she was in HUD housing complex specifically, and her whole thing was she'd live in multiple HUD housing complexes, and it's all about who the manager is. The manager is a dictator, and if you've got a good manager, and she named a couple good managers, she said they could make your whole life worth living, but a bad manager just destroys, it makes you paranoid and worried. And what struck me about what Tim was saying is, and about this whole issue, is when we have these concentrations of poverty, like these big, gigantic barrier blocks now that have gone up in East Portland, everything that happens around someone's situation, it is compounded. Right? So it's like poverty itself, in certain situations, it snowballs. It's like trying to deal with the housing over here, sure. And then there's the education component over there. And, oh, your school's going to get shut down. Oh, but what about the law enforcement? And your kid can't walk down the street without being stopped and told to lie on the ground by a police officer. When it's interesting to me, to create some kind of ownership or transparency, that would be revolutionary, because we would all see all how all these pieces fit together like a puzzle, a bad puzzle, an ugly puzzle. If we could turn it into a pretty puzzle with a little chihuahua, that would be awesome.
Right. No, that would be great.
And we have another caller. We have Mary on the phone. Mary, what are you thinking about today?
Hi, I've lived in 3 Section 8 complexes. I waited 8 years to get my Section 8. I have a mental health disability, high functioning, but my experience is that the owners of the buildings are there's a conglomerate of owners who take a lot of the Section 8, and the maintenance, they take the money, but they do not have upkeep of the places, and somehow Section 8. Somehow, I got no help from the state agencies because of the power of the owners and their perceived reputation.
All right. You know what, Mary? I hate to say this, but we are literally,
okay,
we have 30 seconds left. I hope you call way earlier next time, because I totally want to hear your entire story. It's completely compelling. And I have to say...
Thank you. Good work.
Thank you for calling, Mary. And that's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Malloy Good. Go to our website for links to info about this issue. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. Hope you feel better soon, Sky. This show will be podcast on KBOO.FM by the end of today. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Always look for their March 4th annual show. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, journalist and author Rhys Ehrlich speaks on the Middle East and the Arab Spring, 10 years after the invasion of Iraq. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring an interview with author Gabriella Coleman about her new book, Encoding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. We also hear from Steve Vittoria, the writer, director, producer, and editor of the new documentary, Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal. At 11 o'clock, it's The Food Show. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO would like to invite you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs.
You'll hear Henry and Moggy singing Down Home, Ragtime, and Country.
The True Vine Ramblers, a traditional bluegrass band totally comprised of current hosts of music from the True Vine, along with their special guests and former hosts, Deanne Nelson and Jim Seafelt.
Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends playing old-time fiddle tunes.
And Retta Christie and her one-night stand band, bringing her brand of music that swings between the recesses of jazz and country.
That's Once in a Boo Moon at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church on Saturday, February 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m.
Doors open wide at 6 p.m., so come early. As also included are coffee, delectable desserts, a silent auction, and raffles.
For full details, go to kboo.fm and click on Once in a Boo Moon under KBOO Events. All proceeds go to benefit KBOO, your community radio station.
And now on Political Perspectives this morning, we'll hear a talk given by journalist and author Rhys Ehrlich on the Middle East and the Arab Spring, 10 years after the invasion of Iraq. Rhys Ehrlich spoke at the First Unitarian Church in Portland this past weekend. He is introduced by Gudarz Ekdadari.
It's my great pleasure to introduce my dear friend Rhys Ehrlich. We have been able to have him here and use his knowledge and insight to the whole region in the Middle East. He has been practically everywhere in the region, in Iran, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Lebanon, and the rest of the region from Afghanistan all the way to North Africa. Rhys started his work, he worked with a publishing magazine, investigative journalism, Rampart in San Francisco area for close to 15 years. Currently, he works as a freelance, full-time freelance reporter, and he just came back from Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. His reporting are published and broadcast on many